Joining me now on Inside Ivy Hoops, the man with the highest career scoring average in Yale program history, class of 1971 alumnus, and occasional IHO commenter, Jim Morgan. Thanks so very much for coming on the program, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, Mike. Thank you. I appreciate the invitation and look forward to our chat.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking time out. And I wanted to go back to the beginning. Given such an illustrious career with Yale basketball that eventually came to be, I want to go back to the beginning and just start with what first sparked your interest in basketball?
It's hard to say because it started at a very young age. I was one of nine kids, seven of whom were boys. So we were always involved in some athletic endeavor, some competition of that sort, some sort, baseball, football, tag, you know, any number of things. At some point, and I do remember fairly clearly that I did go out for the fifth grade basketball team. Got cut was I could not dribble the ball the length of the court, and that became a real challenge. And I remember this clearly that became sort of my challenge. I was going to get better, and fell in love with the game. And you know, I played Little League and I played Babe Ruth League and that sort of thing. But about seventh grade, I stopped playing. Pretty much stopped playing all other sports, and stayed with basketball, just played basketball for the rest of my athletic career, and devoted quite a bit of time to it. And by that I mean mental, physical, emotional, spiritual. It was the game I loved. So I stuck with it for pretty much my entire athletic career.
And, well, it turned out to pay off, and I guess the next logical question then is, Yale turned out to be the place that it paid off, but what prompted you to choose Yale in the first place?
I was being pretty heavily recruited. I had a pretty successful high school career. I lived outside Chicago, and I was, like I said, successful all county, all Chicago area. I was recruited. I had a number of Division I schools recruiting me, Duke, Creighton, Davidson, Stanford. But Yale showed some interest, and I'm 5'10", maybe 5'11". I think I was listed on programs as 5'11" because I wanted to appear as though I was a little bit taller than I really was, and I was 155 pounds, 160 pounds maybe, my top weight in college. And as much as I would have loved to have a professional career, in all practicality, it wasn't a given, wasn't a strong possibility. So I opted for the combination of athletics and academics, and I think Yale offered me the best opportunity available.
That's a common refrain for Ivy student athletes, is the academics is so critical, as one might think. So I suppose there's no surprise there.
I think back when I was playing, the level of Ivy League basketball was probably comparable to any in the country. But given my specific situation and physical limitations, if you want to call it that, having that education, having that Yale degree, was certainly going to be an asset to me long term.
Right. And focusing back on the athlete part of the student athlete label, or any highlights from your from your playing days at Yale come to mind? I know your team won the 1969 Rainbow Classic in Hawaii, very famously defeating a LSU squad led by one Pete Maravich, who you actually outscored, correct?
That's correct.
In that game, 35-34, not too many people get to outscore Pete Maravich head-to-head. What? Well, let's start with that one. What was that? What do you recall about that game and that experience now?
Oh, Mike, I have to tell you, I mean, there are moments, there are images, there are tangential aspects to it. It was just sort of a fantasy come true for me and my teammates. We had no idea we were going to play LSU. Obviously, we were going into a tournament. We had a decent team that year. I think we were just under 500. We had a big victory against Princeton, broke a 15 or 16 game losing streak to Princeton with their great team of Jeff Petrie and John Hummer and some of the other players. So we were a good team, but we went into that tournament complete underdogs. One of the newspapers said if the local high school team had been in the tournament, we'd have been ranked ninth out of eight teams. So we were not favored to do very well. But, we played probably the best basketball we could have played all season long in a three-game stretch. And we beat Hawaii, we beat San Francisco, and then we came up against LSU. I'll tell you one little anecdote. I knew we were playing in the Rainbow Classic at the beginning of the season. I knew, obviously, that Pete Maravich and LSU were in the tournament with us. And Pete Maravich was featured on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And I tore off that cover, and I kept that cover with me all season long until we got to the tournament. So it was sort of like a vision, you know, it was an aspiration and vision that actually came true. When you're on the court, well, at least my experience on the court with Pete Maravich is that at moments you almost feel like you're a fan, like you're an observer. You're just watching this magical performance and almost end up as a passerby. You almost stop playing and you start watching, and you have to discipline yourself to stay in the moment, to stay in the game. But we played a fabulous game. I mean, we had guys coming off the bench, you know, contributing, you know, excellent, outstanding play. Jack Langer, who was a player on that team and somewhat notable at the time because of an NCAA ruling against Yale. Now, I remember he scored 14 points and had 15 rebounds, you know, double-double. We shot very well. I remember, I think my shooting, I think I was like 14 for 20. I think I had 22 of my points were in the second half. We played extremely well. We fought back from a deficit in the second half. We had a good plan playing Maravich, and it was basically man-to-man. One guy was guarding Maravich, and I was sagging off. And they had a player on their team. His name was Jeff Hickman, good player. And I remember the start of the second half, he missed seven straight shots. I was sagging off on Maravich, trying to help out a little bit. Hickman was wide open, 15, 18 feet from the basket, and he missed like seven or eight shots in a row, and it was just, he was just out of the game. He was just so flustered. And we held tough. We played great defense. We shot well. We ran our strategy, and we were fortunate enough to win.
Who were you helping to guard Maravich?
A couple of different players. I was not assigned to him. Again, I think the concern might have been that if I was guarding Maravich, first of all, there was a significant height. Second, if I got in foul trouble, that would really jeopardize our chances. So Thatcher Shelleby, who was a senior at the time and the captain of the team, he guarded Maravich. He eventually fouled out. And then a sophomore named Mike McLaren, who was sort of our sixth man, sixth, seventh off the bench at that time. When he came in, he guarded Maravich. And then I would, you know, try to shade wherever Maravich was, I would, you know, try to shade in that direction and just be available if he got, you know, just sort of have a presence to appearance of another defender in the immediate vicinity. But he was just a remarkable player, just a remarkable player. One of the interesting things that happened, you know, Maravich died young of some sort of a heart ailment, I guess it was discovered later on. And it was interesting that on the day that he died, it had a tremendous impact on me and a couple of other people that I played with. I actually called some of my teammates, former teammates, and just, you know, we acknowledged that he had died. And in thinking about it, you know, over the years, it's almost like what happened to us, it was almost like maybe others I think had the same feeling, formed like a sort of a relationship with him, having played against him, having had that opportunity, maybe even the honor of being on the same court with him and competing against him and then beating him. It was sort of like there was this relationship that we felt we had, and we lost that relationship when he died. And, so I do remember calling a couple of guys and talking about it.
Yeah, of course, his death in 1988 at just 40 years old, due to heart failure while playing a pickup basketball game in California.
Wow, you got the details. that's very impressive, Mike.
Well, no, I try to. It's my job to try to, you know, fill in the background. You're doing. You're doing all the heavy lifting right now.
Thanks.
But
you know, bottom line for me is it was the most memorable basketball experience. Certainly collegiate, but lifetime basketball experience I ever had.
Yeah. Yeah. And what other, that's kind of maybe one of the gaudiest moments that could possibly come to mind playing and coming out on top against Pete Maravich head to head. Are there other matchups that come into your mind pretty prominently when you think back to your playing days?
We had some good success against University of Connecticut. University of Connecticut was what was called the Yankee Conference. They weren't the Big East, but we played them every year. We ended up over my 3 years splitting with them 2-2. We beat Syracuse in the Far West Classic. As a matter of fact, as a sophomore, I led the Far West Classic in scoring. It was an 8-team conference played out in Portland, Oregon. Some big name teams from the West Coast as well as the rest of the country, and I led that tournament in scoring. We played against California with Charlie Johnson. Charlie Johnson was eventually named the Naismith Small Player of the Year. I think when I was a senior, I think he won it when I was a senior. We were the same class. One of the things I remember is just the opportunity to play against some great teams in the Ivy League then. We had the chance every single year to play 5 or 6 games against top 25 teams because we played against Penn, Princeton, and Columbia. And there were just great teams back then and some great players, Jim McMillan, Jeff Petrie, Brian Taylor, the fabulous Penn teams. Penn, my senior year, Penn went into the NCAA tournament 28-0. I'm sure you probably know this.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that matchup. Yes.
Yeah, Penn was just a remarkable basketball program back then. I mean, for many years, but definitely during that period of time. And they had that great team, you know, with Steve Bilski and Dave Wall, the backcourt, and Gorky Calhoun and Bobby Morse. And it was, they were just, they just had such a tremendous amount of talent, and they were just so well coached. Dick Harter and Chuck Bailey. It was just a remarkable roster of players and coaches. And then the other teams, you know, Princeton, Columbia, Jim McMillan, perhaps the best player in the Ivy League during my years. He was just a remarkable basketball player. Brian Taylor came on as a sophomore my senior year, and he was an amazing basketball player. So I think one of the things that I think was special was just the opportunity to play that caliber of basketball. And I don't think people these days think of the Ivy League in that way, but back then it certainly was. We also had a tremendous non-conference schedule. We traveled to tournaments throughout the holidays. So besides the Far West Classic and the Rainbow Classic, we played at Tennessee, we played at Marshall, we played a number of different places against LaSalle, against Tennessee, against University of Miami. Played against Ohio State, Bradley, and Butler on a Midwest trip my senior year. So the competition, you know, going back to my choice of Yale, I knew about their schedule. I knew they didn't have the greatest program in terms of success, but I knew they just played a tremendous schedule throughout the year, and the opportunity to play that level of competition back then really appealed to me.
Well, you certainly did get a lot of high caliber matchups over the years. That's for sure. So I guess you got what you signed up for in that sense.
I remember that oftentimes playing away from New Haven was more of a motivation. It was an interesting time to play basketball. It was the Vietnam War, civil rights era. And so on campus, there wasn't a heck of a lot of interest in the basketball program. But when we traveled, we played in stadiums with 10, 12, 15,000 people, and they were packed. And, you know, the name Yale obviously is a draw, but we were always fairly competitive. But I remember my senior year, we played at Bradley, Butler, and Ohio State, and that stretch of games, I averaged somewhere in the area of 24 points a game, because it was a motivation to go out and sort of show that we could compete. It was the challenge of coming up against some of the top teams in the country, and at least, you know, proving that we were competitive and we could play on that level. So that was one of the special, I think, experiences over 3 years at Yale. It's just the level of competition and the opportunity to travel and to play against some of these great teams.
That's interesting. You said that the social unrest of the area of the era, like the Vietnam War, for example, maybe cut into student interest at the games in New Haven at the time?
Well, I think in probably across the country, depending upon the college, depending upon the university. I give you a couple of examples. I guess it was my junior year, the day before our first game of the season, one of our starting players, our center, major player on the team, was involved in a demonstration, you know, peaceful demonstration, anti-Vietnam War demonstration, and there was a possibility that he was likely to get arrested, you know, because he was demonstrating. And we weren't sure. We really weren't sure until, you know, the morning of our first game, whether or not he was going to be available to play. I remember my first Ivy League game was up at Brown. In Providence, and about 10 minutes into the game, there was some movement from the stands, And people from the stands started walking onto the court. And it was a demonstration, a civil rights demonstration. And it was peaceful. It was silent. There weren't a lot of speeches or anything, but we all sort of walked off the court for 10 or 15 minutes and allowed the demonstration to progress. And once it ended, we resumed the game. So that was always, it was always something in the background. You know, there were things happening around the country. There was violence on campus. There was violence in society. And it was part of the time in which we played, which I think at times became a distraction. It became an issue. It became part of our experience, our athletic experience.
Yeah, that's certainly relevant even today, given the buzz around the intersection of social protest and sport, which we're seeing an awful lot more of the past 5 years or so, it seems, since the unrest coming out of Ferguson, Missouri, and other parts of the country.
Well, the Colin Kaepernick controversy.
Right.
So when we were playing in the Far West Classic in Portland, Oregon, I was a sophomore that year. And California was, University of California, Berkeley, was in the tournament. And they had some great basketball players, a guy named Jackie Ridgel, Charlie Johnson, I mentioned earlier, a guy named Bob Presley, big center. And just so happened, we were sitting in an area of the stadium waiting for our game against California. They were a few rows down. Their team was sitting a few rows down. The national anthem played, and none of them stood because this was post Tommy Smith and John Carlos in the 68 Olympics. And, you know, they were expressing their position. So they sat during the national anthem, and you know, there were some cheers and jeers and you know, heckling and whatnot, but it was part of the environment that we were you know, during the time we were playing.
And well, amid that backdrop, what was it like to play for Joe Francisen, who of course well known for later becoming executive director of the National Association of Basketball Coaches, a Dartmouth grad. What was it like to play for Coach Francisen during your time at Yale?
Joe was is a wonderful man. He's a wonderful man. He's a brilliant basketball mind. He had a stellar career. For much of his coaching career, I think it sort of deteriorated toward the end. I think he sort of got a little bit out of sync with college student athletes and struggled, I think, maybe the last 4 or 5 years of his career. But he was a very disciplined, Joe ran a very disciplined system. He came out at Dartmouth. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think the legendary Dartmouth coach was a guy named Julian, Doggy Julian, if I remember correctly. And he created the shuffle, the Dartmouth shuffle, which was a very disciplined five-man movement, constant movement offense. And that's what we played for the most part. Some people liked it, some people didn't. I was pretty comfortable, because it was a motion offense and five guys handled the ball, on almost every possession. So the ball was constantly moving. There wasn't a lot of one-on-one, which may have been a little disadvantage to me, but, still, you know, I generally enjoyed playing in Joe's system. One of the things that I did like about Joe's approach to the game was he liked an up-tempo game. My experience with basketball growing up was up-tempo game, full court pressure, fast break, moving the ball, running. That sort of game appealed to me, and I believe Joe made some adjustments to my style. He actually came up with another offense in my junior year, which was the Rainbow Classic year, that sort of allowed me to control the game a little bit more than the shuffle did. It was pretty successful. We used it pretty effectively in the Rainbow Classic against LSU and the other teams. So I think Joe, made some adjustments. I think complemented my style, which I certainly liked. I think some people found it difficult to play for Joe. And it was interesting. I was the only senior on the team my senior year, which was typical of what was happening at that time. In my sophomore year, there were no seniors on the team. My junior year, there were three seniors on the team, and in my senior year, I was the only senior. So guys would start out with the program, and there was drop-off, which I think hurt the program in the long run.
I hear about the Dartmouth shuffle as much as you do the Princeton offense, do you?
No, yeah. I don't think Princeton's offense is, obviously a motion offense, or has been a motion offense. I think it was a little bit more flexible than the Dartmouth shuffle. The Dartmouth shuffle, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there were, five numbered positions on the floor. And in the Dartmouth shuffle, one went to two, two went to three, three went to four, four went to five, and five went to one. That was the movement. So you had specific spots on the floor from which you started, and the offense was initiated, and each player over the course of play could be in any one of those five positions. So I could very well be in a five-man Dartmouth shuffle. I could very well be in the post position. And our big men could very well be in the the point position. So it didn't lend itself to a roster of slow big men. Joe's most successful teams were teams on which there were six or seven guys who were 6'4 to 6'6 and could play the various positions with fairly equal effectiveness. And if you look at the teams, his most successful teams, they were those types of teams. 6'2", 6'4", 6'6", 6'5", players. All could handle the ball. All could pass the ball. All could move fairly well.
Yeah, I was going to say, you'd have to, in that offense, have players that kind of interchangeably handle the ball and play inside, maybe not a lot of certainly not a lot of isolation or post play, I guess, per se.
The shuffle did not allow for any one-on-one isolation clear out. It was never used that way. It was basically come down, take your position, start the offense, move that ball around, and hopefully free someone up for a good shot. I bet you that Joe changed things around a little bit my junior year. He did institute a sort of a 1-3-1 setup where I started at the point, and there were opportunities, depending upon what I did with the ball, to end up in sort of an for me to end up in an isolated situation, or for players to be set up, in a low post position. And to get the ball and to work it in from there. So he made some adjustments given the makeup of the team he had or the teams he had. But the shuffle was still an integral part of our approach, his approach to the game.
Well,
I will say though, he did love a fast paced game. We would fast break off made free throws. I mean, he actually had a system where we would try to fast break off of made free throws. We would try to fast break off of everything. And I ended up with a couple of films from when we played, and I actually sort of, a little surprised about how fast, how quickly we moved the ball up, how early we shot in the possession. I mean, when we had a shot, we took the shot. Not saying we shot very well, we shot exceptionally well, but we moved the ball and we shot. We shot in pretty early in most possessions.
Well, I know that Dean Smith had a variation of the shuffle offense that he kind of popularized, I guess you could say, later on. But it's good to note that it didn't start with him.
No. I think Dean Smith initiated or created what was referred to as the four corners. If that's what you're referring to, and as a matter of fact, it was used back then for slowdowns. There was a version of it, this without the shot clock, where teams would come up against, they were such underdogs in the game that they would use a version of the four corners to slow the game down, and you would have games where the score was 27-29, 40 minute college game, and because people were stalling, to avoid the runaway game. So
right, yeah.
It was a different brand of basketball. You think about Maravich, and I know this. Guy averaged 44 points, more than 44 points a game for his career. And there was no shot clock, and there was no three-point line. And his coach, Hubie Brown, his coach was at one point a later LSU coach did a shot chart, because they kept detailed shot charts of all of his games. And they figured out if he had played in the three-point era, that his average, instead of 44 points a game, would have probably been closer to 51 or 52. Because he was taking shots that would have been outside the three-point arc, and he was making them at that rate, that he would have made five or six more points per game if there had been a three-point shot.
Wow. Yeah, it makes sense, and it's incredible to fathom. I know that a lot of people are realizing as Matt Morgan has for Cornell is inched up the Ivy scoring record to get second, and still quite a ways behind Bill Bradley, is that Bill Bradley got to over 2,500 career points with one fewer year, no 3-point line, no shot clock. So it's pretty remarkable.
I think if you even look at the number of games played. Most games I played in the season was 25 games. I think I played a total of 3-year career. I had 73 games in my career. And now 30 games, is common. 30 games a season is common. Guys playing 4 years play 120 games. Yeah. And they still don't break Bradley's record in the Ivy League, and they'll never break Maravich's record. And Maravich probably didn't play more than 80 games in his career, his 3-year career. And he still scored all those points. So, it's pretty impressive when you think about those kinds of records and the time that they were, that they made those records.
Yeah. How else is the Ivy League focusing on the league different now from how it was when you played in it? What stand out as the biggest differences to you, if any?
I don't know. I I think basketball itself has gone through a number of revolutions, just revolutionary episodes. The rules of the game have changed, the athleticism, the physicality of the players, not the physicality of the game necessarily. Basketball, when I played, was rough and tough, and still can be rough and tough. Physical specimens that are playing the game now, is a huge, a pretty huge difference. We didn't play during an era of AAU ball. We went to basketball practice for 2 hours. That was it. You didn't have weight room. You didn't have film sessions. The amount of time that was devoted to the game back then was I think very different, at least from my experience. I don't remember ever watching a film to scout another team or to learn something about the opposition in my 3 years at Yale. Never. It just wasn't part of the emphasis, at least at Yale, and I would guess probably throughout the Ivy League. We didn't have shoot arounds before the games on the day of the game. We didn't have walkthroughs, on the morning of a game. We showed up at training table at 4 o'clock and went over and watched the freshmen play and then went in and got dressed for our game about, 6:30 for a 7 o'clock game. So I think just the whole emphasis, the time commitment, is pretty different. I think there are a couple of things that really changed the game. I think the cupping of the ball. I tell you, Mike, I would have loved to be able to cup the ball the way they cup the ball now. I mean, you can make three moves with that ball cupped in your hand and not dribbling it. When I was playing, it would have been turnover after turnover after turnover. That just would have been called the walking, traveling violations that are now sort of overlooked or ignored, especially in the pro game, not so much in college. But I think when an offensive player can cup the ball the way they can now, I think that puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the defense. So, you got to be much more athletic, I think, to play both sides of the ball. I would say that sort of athleticism, physicality of the players, and then there's the time devoted to the game. Probably one of the biggest differences from when I was playing.
We were talking a little bit before we started recording, but what came after graduating from Yale for you?
I did have an interest in playing professional, but that just didn't work out. I was hoping maybe to land something overseas, but that just wasn't in the cards. So I started coaching. I was Joe Van Sissen's, one of his assistants, for a number of years. I was the head freshman basketball coach because back then freshmen played separately from the varsity. So I was a freshman basketball coach for a few years. Went into education, became a teacher, an administrator, eventually director of a professional development center, and basically had a lengthy career in education. Also spent quite a bit of time coaching my own kids when they were growing up, travel teams, recreation league basketball, and that sort of thing. And I had some wonderful experiences with that. Coaching my own kids, some other kids from the areas in which I lived.
Well, that's pretty cool. That's very neat. What? How closely do you get to follow Yale basketball these days?
I live in White Plains, New York, which is only an hour away from New Haven. So I probably get to 6, 8, 10 games a year. I'll attend a lot of the home games. Occasionally I'll go down to Columbia when they play there, or I'll head up to Harvard, Boston, If it's if it's a big game against Harvard, which most of them are, they've been playing Iona, which is right nearby in recent years. So, you know, depending upon the team, depending upon the season, I may get 10 games. The 2016 team, when we played at in the NCAA tournament up in Providence, I was at both of those games with some of my former teammates. So I follow them pretty closely. You know, they have distribution lists, and Coach Jones sends us a summary of the games that were played over a weekend. People in the distribution list, mostly players, get a little summary from the coach with his insights and observations, which is nice. So I stay fairly close to Yale's program.
Are you?
And I follow you guys on Ivy Hoops Online all the time.
Well, I have. Yeah.
So I get the insight from all of the Ivies.
Well, yeah, I had to. I kind of mischievously added that in your introduction at the top. But, yeah, no, we're
Richard Kent, one of your writers, is an acquaintance. I actually see him frequently at the Yale games. We keep in touch. We text one another occasionally during a game or at post game to share our thoughts.
Well, Richard does a fantastic job for the site, and we're very honored that. That you read the site and keep up with the site, obviously.
No, I appreciate it. I don't think the Ivy League gets the media coverage that it deserves, and having something like Ivy Hoops is really good for an Ivy League loyalist, an Ivy League fan like myself. So I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, it's a labor of it's a passion for us, so we enjoy it. We enjoy it.
You can tell. Yeah, good.
So, what are you the hot button issue of the day here? What are you excited about having the Ivy League tournament at Yale this season?
Oh, absolutely! But the problem for me is I have a family wedding on the 16th of March, so I can't attend. I mean, here's the one year at Yale; it won't be there for another 7 years, according to this rotation.
Yeah,
which drives me crazy. But I think it's a great advantage. It's not so much playing on your home court as it is sleeping in your own bed, not having to get on that bus and travel and get off with, travel legs. You're in your own environment. You're following your regular routine for the most part. I mean, obviously, you're playing at a tournament, so that changes it somewhat. But you're still, it's a real advantage for the home team. I think, and being a Yale fan, we'll take the advantage anytime we can get it. I think we've got a good shot this year. A couple of disappointing losses, unexpected losses, but I think we have a good shot at it. I think at this point, unless I'm mistaken, if we run the table and Harvard runs the table, I think we're probably the 2 seed. I think Harvard might win on a head-to-head, if that's one of the determinations. I'm not exactly sure. And if we're the 2 seed, I think that means we got to go through Princeton and we got to go through Harvard. I would expect Harvard to beat the 4 seed, and we would have to beat Princeton, which is likely to be the 3 seed, and then we'd have to probably face Harvard in the final. And that's that's a tough. It's a tough 2-game sequence there.
Yeah, it sure is. But at least Yale's got the the home atmosphere, I guess you could say. What are your thoughts on the location of the tournament, where it is going forward, and where you think it should be?
I don't like their decision about the rotation. I just while it seems fair and equitable, and that may be the nature of things in this era, I just I just cannot see Ithaca. Very honestly, I can't see going up to Ithaca or Hanover, New Hampshire, in the middle of March. It just, you know, you just have so many risky weather conditions. Travel issues, cancellations, travel cancel. I just don't think it makes sense. I think if you're going to do something like that, well, I mean, I just don't think it makes sense to do something like that. I would prefer that they come up with a neutral site if possible. I'll give you my two preferences. I don't like the rotation. I would prefer a neutral site. I think there are some venues that are, you know, in more southern New York, southern Connecticut. They might give some of the teams an advantage in that their travel is less than other teams, but at least the home court advantage is eliminated. So I would prefer a neutral site, but. Ivy League site. Go to the Palestra. As a player, I would rather play the tournament every year at the Palestra than rotate to the lesser venues. Now, as a player, you want to play at the Cathedral. Very honestly, I always loved going on the road to Penn. It was just, you know, playing in that atmosphere. Now, we never drew when we played the Ivy League game, always preceded the Big Five game. So when we played, we didn't draw the big crowd, but by the time our game was over and we watched the second game, it was just amazing. Just the spirit, the exuberance, the thrill of being there and watching a game and, you know, in that stadium was fabulous. So as a player, even if it wasn't my home court, even if there was a slight disadvantage, I would still have wanted to play at the Palestra, the tournament at the Palestra.
Well, the Ivy League tournament, as we know, with the rotational schedule, is not going to be there for quite some time, at least well into the next decade now. So it just seemed to be too much of an outcry against it, especially with Penn as the Penn men and women as the 2 seed hosting last year. Too much opposition, I think, ultimately. So we've got the rotational schedule. It's here, and you know, for better and worse, we have to live with it and make the best of it. So
Badly, we'll feel badly for schools whose fans will not travel to Ithaca or will not travel to Hanover, especially if there's any kind of a possibility of weather issues. Also, Columbia's, you know, 2 seed or Princeton's a 1 seed, and you know, their diehards will get there probably somehow, but I just think it's just fraught with risks. We'll see. You know, I never thought either Dartmouth's gymnasium or Cornell's I don't know what you would call Cornell's gymnasium. I just never thought they were very attractive places to play, and you know the. The hike up there was just miserable. It was just miserable. So I would hope, if nothing else, they will permit every team to travel the night before. I know there are some limitations on overnight travel. I think distance is a factor and during regular season play that some teams are not permitted to travel up on a Thursday night if they're playing on Friday. They have to leave midday on Friday. And, you know, not only is that a tough trip, but it really is tough on you know, you're playing with dead legs after sitting on a bus for 4 hours or so driving those distances. So I just don't like the idea.
Well, we're, as you said, we're in wait and see mode at this point. Yeah. So Are you on board with the idea of having a tournament at all, a league tournament?
Yeah, I am. I am. And really, the only reason I love the 14 game tournament. I love the 14 game season, and winner goes. I just, you know, think that's the true test. But one of the reasons I like the idea of a tournament is the increased possibility of a second bid for the Ivy League. Somebody has a fabulous season, maybe gets a couple of big victories, non-conference victories, like our team this year. A couple of good wins non-conference, and then loses, gets upset in the tournament. Well, I think under those circumstances, there's a possibility of getting a second Ivy League team into the NCAA tournament, which I think it would be good. I think that's a positive. I know if you guys referred to it, an article Steve Bilski wrote for Pennsylvania or Philadelphia newspaper, in which he described some of his thoughts, and I liked a couple of his ideas. I think one of the ideas was maybe giving the first seed the home court advantage. Well, that's a possibility. I also like the idea of a three-team tournament where the winner of the conference championship gets a bye, 2 and 3 playoff, and then the winner plays the conference champion. I think that also has some merit, but a postseason event, I think, is a good thing for the Ivy League.
Yeah, I happen to agree with you. I think, and yes, that was a pretty thoughtful article that Steve Bilski wrote for the Daily Pennsylvanian, Penn student newspaper. I agree with you. I think it would be a little fairer and still interesting from a horse race perspective into who gets into the tournament to have it to cap it at 3 seeds and have the one seed play the winner of the 2 and 3, whether it's ideally the with the one seeds hosting. But again, this is all, it's not going to happen, but we can talk about what we'd like to see anyway. That makes sense to me. That's the route.
I would like to see somewhere along the line the Ivy League acknowledged as a competitive league by getting a second bid. When I was playing, there weren't 64 plus 4 invited to the NCAA tournament. When I was in high school, there were 8 or 16 in the NCAA tournament, and then by the time I was in college, there were I think it was 25 each year, and a couple of those got byes to eventually even it out. Back then it was mostly the conference champions, and the conferences didn't play tournaments. Most of them didn't play tournaments. It was the season conference champion that was invited to the NCAA tournament, and then some independents. A lot of the Catholic schools back then were independents, like St. Bonaventure, LaSalle, Villanova. They were not conference teams. They weren't in conferences. They were Providence. They were all independents. So they would get a number of independents would be invited, but then it would be the conference champions across the country. And that was it.
Yeah, it
would seem to me. It would seem to me that we should get the Ivy League should get at least 2 of those slots. When we have 2 good teams with good seasons, I think for us to be denied a second slot just because we're the Ivy League is really an unfair situation.
Well, certainly the league has gotten appreciably better over the past the past decade or so, relative to the rest of the leagues, when you look at conference metrics and other measurables. So perhaps perhaps that second bid isn't so far out of reach.
I think if you look at the success of some of the the Ivy League teams in the NCAA tournament, winning, you know, a couple of games. Cornell a few years back when they had that great those great years. We can obviously compete our season against Baylor and then coming back against Duke in 2016. I just think that Harvard's had some good runs in the tournament. So you would think, you know, that we would get a little bit more respect than we typically get.
Yeah. Well, it's just a matter of time, I think. we'll get to push ahead and get to that point, and hope that the NCAA at large takes notice, I suppose. A lot to take notice with your career, that's for sure. One of the greatest standouts in Yale and Ivy history. Jim Morgan, thank you so very much for coming on Inside Ivy Hoops and imparting such great insight. We really appreciate you taking time out to come on.
Mike, thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate you having me on, and I really enjoyed the time that we had to talk together.
Well, likewise, truly. Hope we will stay in touch here as the season progresses, and thanks so much again.
Well, I'm sure you'll see me post a comment now and again after one of the articles. So you'll hear from me.